I wouldn't say we fell in love right away. I think we were, as they call it in the biz, trauma bonding.
And then after 8 years of being insufferably sober, I started drinking again.
Addicts tend to be rather sensitive people.
Aren't you Marc Maron? I'm like, yeah. And she goes, what happened to you?
So, hi, you're listening to Light Hustler. I never even told my guest I changed the name.
Oh.
Yeah, I hope that he doesn't cancel right now.
It's quite a change.
It's a change. We'll get into that. The podcast, formerly known as Recover Girl and formerly known as After Party Pod, I've changed it a few times. I'm your host, Anna David. Thank you so much for listening. Welcome to the podcast if you're new. I am going to get right into my guest because it's John Taylor from Duran Duran. I'm being completely calm and cool. He has no idea what's going on inside. But this is a true thrill and an honor. And I'm just so glad that you're doing this.
You're welcome.
He's also an author, and I devoured his autobiography. When did it come out?
About 5 years ago now.
5 years ago. And you actually wrote it yourself.
Well, I mean, I did have a guy working with me. I don't think I could have done it without him, actually. I wrote the cornerstones mm-hmm. by myself, but you know, there's a huge amount of research and involved. And I mean, by actually getting the book, you know, printed and released required a lot of minds, you know, other than my own. I was really humbled by the experience, actually. I mean, I've always respected authors. But after that, more so than ever, really, just how much work is involved. So I'd like to claim it all as my own, but Tom Sykes does have a credit on the cover.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. He's a good writer, too. Did you know him from sort of Fabulous Britishness?
I knew his sister Plum. And actually, Tom had come to my wife, Gila. He wanted to tell the juicy story and pitched her with that, and that didn't work out. So he said, well, what about you? Who are you? What do you do? I'm like, I'm a musician. He goes, well, why don't you tell your story? I mean, no, not quite like that, but it was a moment in time, actually, when Keith Richards had just put out his book, and everybody, the walls were just falling. Everybody who could play guitar was ready to tell all. And so the timing was quite good for me. But yeah, I mean, no, it's really about memory, you know. You know, I'd lost both my parents at that point, and I'd lost, you know, and with them went the connection to place that was the street that I grew up on, that I went back to my entire life because my dad died in that house. Mm. The city that sort of raised me and nourished me. And so a lot of the book was a tribute to all of that. And and also I think it was, you know, I mean, the band now, most of our conversations are like memory tests.
Mm.
And of course I'm thinking, wow, these guys have got really bad memories. I'm going to have to put it down on paper because I'm the one with a memory. And actually, since, I mean, only the other day something came up and I realized that I got some timing wrong in one of the chapters. Not that anybody
reprint,
not that it really matters, but I was like, oh my God. Oh, so, yeah, but it was a good thing to do. I mean, I'm definitely glad I did it.
Had you thought about doing it before? I'm imagining people came to you before that.
Not really. I mean, the people that came to me said, we're going to help you. You know, it's not going to be. I mean, I suppose one does think about it because I'm a very occasional diarist, you know, like when I feel the need to, you know, to fill a few pages of, you know, of what's going on with me right now or some kind of memory, I will do it. So I did have a few ideas about events and how I could tell them. Mm-hmm. I think I knew the attitude of the book. You know, mm-hmm. I knew the voice of the book and what it was going to be. Yeah. And but it wasn't something that I really seriously thought about doing. Now I think about doing another one, but what would it be about?
Yeah. Well, it's there's always going to be more.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm actually, I think I like plumbing the same depths in a way, you know, like looking deeper into the same material, you know, rather than going in a completely opposite direction, different direction. I quite like the idea of really going in the same direction, but going deeper. But I'm not sure what that would be.
Well, and what's interesting is in terms of having the memory, you know, in being in recovery, there's a lot of work of unearthing. So it's sort of like you've done a lot of your prep work in, you know, because we're forced to look back, especially when we first get into it. And are you 15 years?
20 something.
Oh, God, I was trying to feel superior. I forgot you had more time than I did. But that is a huge part of it, is sort of taking inventory, looking back, and re-examining through new eyes.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, most people that don't take the sober route, that aren't in 12-step programs, have no sense of the amount of work that those of us that are have to do. And that, you know, you know, there's a reason why we don't drink or use mind-altering chemicals one day at a time, because, you know, just every day we have to kind of recommit to that idea. And, you know, and I think one of the things that gets said that I heard early on is that, you know, what keeps you sober today may not necessarily keep you sober tomorrow. And, you know, and I found the amount of things that come up mm-hmm. with me, amount of, let's call them issues, mm-hmm. for want of another term.
Why not?
The amount of issues that come up that really on a normal day, on a pre-sober day, I would have a drink over.
Yeah.
You know, I'd just drink over it. Deal with it.
Yeah.
It'd just be done with.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not an option. So we have to really put those issues under the magnifying glass and break them down or uncover, discard.
Yeah. You know?
And it's, look, there are times you can coast a little. There are times when you can just, you know, you can get by, but inevitably something will come up mm-hmm. and, you know, and it's usually something that's very close to you. It's usually something to do with family or, mm-hmm. or work or self-esteem, you know, and it's just something that there's no external fix for,
right?
You know, that you just, I mean, even though I'm all about external fixes.
Oh, me too. Love them.
You know, I mean, if I can buy a new piano over it, you know, then I'll do that.
And that will work for like 15 minutes or even 15 days sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I, you know, when I sold my first book, I remember thinking, if I just sell my first book, I'm going to be happy for the rest of my life. Yeah. That'll be it. And it lasted 2 weeks. And then I was like, oh my God, there's a second one.
Yeah.
When you were coming up as a, you know, as a young man, did you have that? Or was it not even conscious of, I'm going to feel happy, I'm going to be fulfilled as long as we're a hit, and then it happened?
I mean, I don't think that I was an unhappy kid. Quite the opposite, actually. I think I was quite happy in myself. But the career kind of required me to be a lot, or it seemed to me at the time, to be a lot bigger personality than really what I was. So, you know, in order to expand, you know, I had to be so many things in such a short space of time.
And you didn't have time to think about it even.
You know, I mean, like almost within a space of 12 months, I had to become like a worker, you know, a partner in a firm. I had to become a, you know, a laborer working with a team of people. You know, I was an only child. Suddenly I had four brothers. I'd never left home. I didn't get a passport until after our first record came out. Suddenly I'm traveling all over the world and adjusting to all these time changes, jet lag, you know, cultural, you know, opportunities, you know, and the demands of, you know, of the job, you know, moving from my hometown, leaving my parents' house. I mean, actually, my, you know, I mean, what the book, one of the big, like, kind of revelations that the research for the book brought me to was that after the Rio album came out, which was like the big global smash, I was still living with my parents. I was still occupying my old bedroom, which was about 8 foot by 6 foot.
Wow.
I was still occupying. I was going back, you know, after touring America, touring Japan for the first time, you know, big Christmas tour of Britain, going home to my, you know, to my old home with my parent, where my parents lived. And like, you know, and like, you know, 2 days after getting back and after like the novelty of the young pop star coming home, you know, I'd worn off, like fighting with my dad over what we were going to watch on the television set,
right.
And thinking, I think it's time to move on. I think it's time to go. But, you know, they're big steps. And the romance, you know, all the romances and, you know, really high emotional, you know, really, really, you know, just a lot of stuff happened in that first year, even, you know, subsequent to us putting our record out. I mean, I met Simon in June of 1980, and he was like he complete the circle, you know. And right away, we started writing the songs that would become our first album. We were fortunate to make a record deal within 4 months, maybe 5 months of Simon joining.
It's crazy.
And, you know, and we had our first record out in January 81. So I'd known Simon, you know, for 6 months. And then we were off. You know, it was a lot, you know, it was a lot to adjust to. You know, and most of it was fun, but you know, for me, the alcohol and drugs, particularly, like, were stronger than I was, and I didn't realize that at the time.
Right.
I couldn't understand why the rest of the guys were like, when they said they were going to bed, they went to bed, and when they said they were going to go to the hotel bar and have one drink, and I was the one that more and more often found myself like crawling back to the hotel, you know, at 5-6 a.m. in the morning, you know,
right.
Leonardo DiCaprio and the Wolf of Wall Street, you know, just like as everybody else is getting ready to leave. And I'm like, what's, you know,
what's wrong with them?
Yeah, well, yeah, what's wrong with them? No, but more often, what's wrong with me? And you know, also, I think that the lifestyle, you know, I got so quickly into this lifestyle, and I wanted to be living it, you know, 24/7. And I just didn't know what to do with myself, particularly when there wasn't anything happening, even though it was a very busy time. Inevitably, there would be a couple of days when my services weren't required. And
right.
That's really when I would get into trouble. I mean, that's something that I came to understand, you know, in more recent years, like in the last 30 years, 20 years, like it's what you do with your time off. It's sort of, I hate this phrase that sorts the men out from the boys, but you know, it's one thing when it's all about when you're working and everything is on and you can deal with it. It's like when you've got nothing, you know, when you've got no responsibilities, that's when you really have to be careful.
Oh my God. There's so many things you said that I want to talk about. Okay, this is so interesting to me, this thing that, you know, that you were a happy, well-adjusted kid, loved all of these things. Then this happened to you. And we were talking before we started recording about, like, how much is lifestyle and circumstance? Do you think, had you not become a major pop star, that possibly you would never have developed alcoholism at the level that you did and needed to get sober?
Well, you know, anybody that is, that sort of diagnoses themselves with alcoholism, as I did, and ends up in a 12-step program. I mean, we do kind of accept the idea that there's a genetic problem, and that, you know, whatever it was that, you know, whatever our life experience had been, we would have ultimately, you know, encountered our alcoholism. So, you know, and I found that a really good. I like that idea. And I think it's one of the things that, I mean, I was thinking about talking to you today and you know, and what it is about, you know, about 12-step program that just makes it so powerful today. I think it's, you know, there's a reason why it's growing, you know, and one of the reasons is that we kind of take responsibility, you know. We don't blame our parents, we don't blame our partners, we don't blame our teachers, you know. I mean, look, we can look at the effects of our parents' experience. We can look at the effect of, you know, what happened to us when we went to school. But ultimately, we kind of accept that, you know, there's a genetic difference between us and people that can take alcohol or leave it, shall we say.
Right.
And that was a very important idea for me to buy into. Because I was so filled with blame and resentment. I mean, by the time I got to the end of my 20s, it's sort of my career had been and gone. I mean, I was over. I was washed up, really. I mean, I'd been in a band that had a lot of hits, and I'd been a pop star and on a lot of people's walls, but I was washed up. I was just this blob of like guilt and shame and resentment. And that I'd had all these opportunities, and you know, and I'd blown it. Basically, I was very, very, you know, hard on myself. But consequently, everybody that was close to me, such as my parents, really got it.
Yeah.
You know, I used to call them up and say, "It's your fault that I," etc., etc. And you know, and right away, in my first introduction to our step program, I was told, no, it's not about them. It's not about, you could have been, you, for instance, I was an only child. I thought, that's got something to do with it. Why didn't my parents give me a brother or a sister? You know, it's like, well, you could have had, you know, five brothers and five sisters, and you would have still been an alcoholic. You would have still had these problems. Oh, well, it's because I was a pop star. And well, no, you could have actually been a bus driver, and you would have been an alcoholic. And it was like, and I kind of thought, and I remember thinking, well, it's not so much believing that, it's just appreciating that the idea is significant. That if you can just even acknowledge that that's an interesting idea, because I think, you know, jury's out as to whether there is incontrovertible scientific proof.
Right.
But it is a good idea. And it's something that, because most people that get sober, let's say in midlife, let's say any after their mid-20s onwards, almost always they're full of anger and fear and resentments, you know, and they're generally pointing their finger at everybody that got them in that mess that they find themselves in that moment. And we don't do that. We say, no, you got to look inside. That's where the problem is. And this idea of this faulty gene, you know, is like, really? Okay. All right. I guess I can go with that. Won't hurt anybody to go with that idea for a while. And then we get to work, you know.
Yeah, I always look at it as, you know, because when I didn't think there were any alcoholics in my family when I got sober, it was only, you know, sort of, it quickly became revealed to me that it was called different names, but that's what it had been. But I think of it as we have a genetic predisposition, and then that's either sort of exacerbated or diminished depending on what happens to us. But speaking of good ideas to believe, something in your story that I really relate to is it was the cocaine that really like sort of amped it up. I don't know about you, but when I was first exploring sobriety and rehab, I was just like, yeah, alcoholism, addiction, different. Appreciate the fact that you think they're the same. Not to me. Did you ever have any of that?
Say that again.
Like, just not because cocaine was the major problem, not really believing that that was alcoholism, sort of saying, well, that's addiction and that's different, so I can keep drinking.
Well, one thing I knew was I very rarely got into cocaine if I was sober. It was usually that I have like, you know, one polite drink, and then I'd start thinking, it'd be nice to have a little Coke. Mm-hmm. You know, it always followed. So alcohol was the gateway for me. I never really thought of myself as like an alcohol lover.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, I never, very rarely would I drink myself into a stupor. But, you know, it was just this, you know, it just loosened my barriers, my scruples, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Coke definitely, Yeah, I mean, it just helped me be, it helped with one of the characters that I felt needed to be amplified.
The big
one of the aspects. Well, I think, you know, like, you know, certainly the after party player, you know, like the job's done, mm-hmm. you're exhausted, time to go home and go to bed. Well, no, I don't want to do that. I want to like reap the fruits of my labors. I want to get out there. I want to party. I want to have a good time. And, I felt that I needed a little help to do that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've got a little bit of a manic personality anyway. I mean, you know, I still kind of use coffee today a little bit. Like, I have to really watch it, you know, because like if I've got a day off, you know, we're talking about time on your hands. If I've got a day off, no responsibilities, that to me is an excuse to have at least 6 espressos throughout the course of the day. That's how I get off. And Coke was like that, you know, and it just I could go at it all night and, it was fun at first, you know, and then it did start to get in the way of things. It started to get in the way of work, started to get in the way of creativity. And so you'd think, well, then you've got to cut down on the drugs, right? And I was like, no, I really need to cut down on the work, you know, because that became the primary thing for a few years. And, you know, and I often talk, you know, I don't mind talking in meetings, but I'll tell anybody how really at the peak of the band's, you know, first wave of fame, you know, which was probably 1984, we were touring, we were playing places like the Forum here in LA, Madison Square Gardens. That was really the time that I was really flying. And, you know, I couldn't really appreciate what was happening to me. You know, I was too busy thinking about where my next fix was going to come from, and just to make sure that I had what I needed for the after party. And I think that happens to a lot of people that get into recovery, is that they realize that, you know, because they had this addiction, you know, and the addiction was causing them to behave in certain ways, and they actually got to miss out on so many of, like, you know, nature's generosity. You know, you hear all the time about people that, you know, they weren't there for the birth of their child or the death of a parent or, right. you know, all sorts of things that they checked out, you know, because they were too busy chasing their needs, you know, their addict's needs. And so we kind of come back and we become very, very driven, actually. I think, you know, sober people are very, very driven to make up for what they lost. And, you know, and this starts out almost as a bit of shame, but then it's just like, well, look, I've got all this energy today, you know, and, there's this, you know, and you start feeling a little righteous because you're sober and, you know, nobody else, you know, you don't have a hangover. And, but, you know, you do get this chance to put it right in a way.
Well, and also the thing that you said that I really relate to is this idea of the day off, and like, especially talking about it back then, but even now,
yeah.
For me, work is a way I escape. I channel that quote unquote alcoholism, and I've spent so long beating myself up for it. And now I'm like, terrific. I try to tell myself this anyway. What a healthy, sure, there are healthier escapes, but what a wonderfully productive way to channel that. Do you relate to that?
I mean, I know that I love giving myself days off. I mean, I go at it quite hard. I go at work quite hard. I'm quite demanding on myself, and I'm quite driven still, actually, to get things done. But equally, I kind of love it when there's a vacuum, and I can just kind of.
What do you do?
Slum.
What do you slum? What's slumming like to you?
I mean, I'll watch like 3 games of soccer, you know. I mean, I'll just like, I'll do crosswords, you know. I mean, I like to read, you know. I mean, I think when you're an artist, it's like everything is material. It's very difficult to do anything that doesn't in some way relate to my work.
Mm-hmm. Even the crossword?
Well, yeah, because you're keeping your brain going, aren't you? I mean, that's very much, I think, it's like a brain workout. You're keeping keeping your brain working. It's all about word. It's also about words. Actually, like, I'm not kidding. Like, watching soccer, which is, I can watch, like, you know, a couple of games a week. And that is one of the few things that I do, that when I'm doing it, I feel like I'm absolutely doing nothing right mm-hmm. now. And
how does that relate to art?
And what I'm saying, it doesn't.
Okay, it's the one thing.
So it's entirely like, I don't need to be, I can watch it and I don't need to feel like I need to be taking the experience and somehow like considering how it's going to impact on the next series of songs we're going to work out. I mean, I actually watch quite a lot of TV at night.
You do. What are your favorites right now?
Well, I've been watching The Looming Tower.
I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, that's about the lead up to 9/11 and the mm-hmm. 9/11 attacks, and it's about the CIA and the FBI. And I mean, there's a lot of, I think it's a sort of, we're going through like a renaissance period for TV, film, sort of long form TV. I think it's just fantastic kind of dramas on Netflix particularly, but on Hulu. And I need to, it takes me a couple of hours to wind down at night. You know, I can't sort of, you know, I mean, I won't do any like business, sort of after 6:30, 7 o'clock, really.
Yeah.
I have to get that out of my head.
Yeah.
Before, if I'm going to fall asleep peacefully.
Yeah, same. Do you, and so you did a little bit of acting, you know, in the Alison Anders movie and other things. Do you think about, would you want to do
TV? Not really. I mean, there are just too many people that it's their life's work, you know. And, I mean, that was the experience that I had, you know. I mean, I did a few things and I would encounter these people that, you know, they felt about acting the way I felt about music. I mean, you're lucky if you can identify one passion. You know, if you can say, you know what, that's my thing and I'm going to spend my life dedicated to that, which is how I feel about music. Mm-hmm. The idea that, you know, that I'm so gifted,
right.
You know, that I could be an actor. Yeah, it's a little much. But I have to say, you know, I've been working on a musical with Nick and so we've been, we've been working on the dialogue. We've been working on actors, and occasionally I'll stand in as one of the. I mean, we both do. We'll both occasionally stand in, and that exchange with actors is really good fun. And I can see why it's so appealing to people. And it sort of appeals in the way that, you know, that performing music does. I always like, you know, that like someone counts off the song. Or the lights go down at the beginning of the show, and it's like this suspension of reality, and the music takes mm-hmm. over, and also the partnership. It's, you know, like when I'm playing a song, you know, I'm playing it with like 4, 5, 6 other people, and it's this kind of like, it's a conversation that we're having,
mm-hmm.
but the terms of the conversation are entirely the song, are entirely the music, and I love that because it's, you know, it's not this. You know, it's because that's what it is. And then, you know, the lights come up and you're backstage and it's back to personalities and it's back to, you know, everybody's opinions. And that's how we tend to go through the day, right? We're
right.
sort of bouncing around from one person's opinion to another. Or that's how we communicate. And acting has that too. You know, it's like someone says action or you start the scene and it's like, and everything else, you know, butts out.
Well, it's the escape.
Yeah.
It's that, it's soccer, it's alcoholism, you know, it's for me work. It's that, you know, escape from that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, life's quite challenging, isn't it? In terms of like, you know, you got to keep making it up. And also, I say make it up, but you got to be careful to keep your story straight, you know, so you don't get caught out, you know. So, you know, throughout the day, I was reading yesterday that, you know, that the speed of our culture is such that you encounter 4 times as many words. We encounter 4 times as many words today than we would have done 30 years ago.
You mean just online and?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just that. I mean, everywhere. Online is a big part.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, as an information sort of delivery system.
So that's a very positive way to look at it.
Is it? Well, it just means you need more processing power, which is why, you know, I can't find my computer cable. And when you arrive and you go, you mean that computer cable?
Right,
and I say, yes, that one, because my brain has been occupied with, there's so much processing going on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, I mean, I also go back and forth from the United States to England all the time. And that also, you know, requires a certain amount of, you know, I mean, I feel like I do a lot of juggling, actually, and throughout the course of any given day, at least once, often twice, I feel like I'm just about to drop all the plates. You know, and it's just like, okay, I got it. You know, they're all still there.
Yet sometimes I just trip out on how much is expected of us to even just remember. You know, I was telling you, I just got back from Toronto and it was like losing my passport and losing my keys. And it's like, God, this world really has high expectations of us.
Well, I mean, you didn't have to go, you know.
True.
You know, I mean, you can always choose to stay home all day.
But even driving around LA, I just sort of am like, wow, there's just so much that I'm expected to be able to handle. And I do.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of us our lives are the center of hurricanes. We're all at the center of our own tornado.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it is personal and some of it is impersonal. You know, I think the 24-hour news cycle has a lot to answer for. I think that has raised the fear level, you know, so that there's this noise that's going off, constant presence of a fear that really wasn't there 20 years ago. You know, the conversation. I mean, one of the things I do love about AA, one of the things I really do love about the 12-step program is that it's very neutral. You know, we are non-political, we are apolitical. And I feel it's very important. I'm so glad that I have that, that, you know, something that is such a big part of my life is apolitical. Not that I'm not, you know, one way over the other, but I don't have to, you know, dedicate my life to being angry at half the population.
Right.
You know, and I don't want to be that,
right.
You know, and, you know, and I've come to, you know, appreciate, I mean, I had a very elite, rarefied education as an adult. You know, I mean, I made money quite early on. I was a star. I got surrounded by love and certain kinds of yes men and certain kinds of sycophancy. But my experience in the 12 steps has brought so many people into my life that I would never have gotten to know.
Right.
You know, and I'm so grateful for that, because I really feel like I've got a sense of people, of the real world.
Right. That's
interesting. And you know, and I also, I'm very much about the similarities rather than the differences. We just got back from Russia actually. And you know, and I'm, and I, and, and people would say to me, oh, my God, Russia. I mean, and I'm like, they're people just like us.
Right.
You know, and their politicians are just like ours. And their media is just like ours. But at the end of the day, the people are just like you and I.
Right.
You know, but there are these systems, without getting too, like, that want to keep us apart.
Yeah.
And I feel that, like, you know, it's very easy to fall into a trap where you start buying into the differences. Oh, you know, I'm different than X. You know, where, you know, I'm different. You know, Americans, we're different to blah, blah. You know, I'm a Catholic. I'm different for all these differences that really, my experience, just kind of isolate us.
Absolutely.
And I don't want to hear about that. I want to hear about how we are all the same. We have all the same needs. We have all the same likes, appreciations. That's another thing that's great about soccer. It's like it's a totally democratic deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things I'm most proud of about my achievements as a musician. Every time I walk out on stage, I see all kinds of people, you know, and I see people that perhaps wouldn't normally hang together. But we create an environment. Our music is the excuse for people to come. And, you know, and I really, really appreciate that. You
mm-hmm.
know, I've come to, that's something I probably appreciate more than almost anything about what we get to do.
Yeah, because we really, I'd never heard that before. Like, you look for the similarities and not the differences. And my mind was just this sponge when I came in. Anything people told me, yes. Thank God I was only, you know, I didn't encounter any like super sick people who told me really crazy things, because I would have done it. And I, that had never occurred to me either. You know, okay. So something that I'm very interested in, it's something that I read that you said, it was sort of about being in an extended adolescent, like still feeling like, you know, we're adolescents. It's said that alcoholism sort of freezes you at the age that you start becoming alcoholic or start using, but also fame has to be a double freeze. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, there's a lot of responsibilities that, you know, that you have to take on in normal life that you simply don't have to deal with if you're, you know, if you're successful, really, you know, I mean, famous, yes, but successful. People offer their services to you and you think, well, why don't I just pay this guy to open my mail and pay my bills? Because then it gives me more time to, well, theoretically, it gives me more time to create,
right.
But also more time to self-destruct. Yeah, I mean, look, that's, I think I don't really know anybody that doesn't have like, that is fully their age, you know, nobody, you know, I'm a man in his late 50s that is wrestling with a 14-year-old boy continually,
right.
You know, that just happens to be in me.
Right.
You know, but I'm also kind of wrestling with a 25-year-old, you know, that kind of missed out when we toured and that 25 kind of has his, you know, he kind of comes up sometimes and, you know, and I've got to like sit down and talk to him and reason with him. And, you know, I've got to like basically let all these personalities inside me know I got this.
Right.
It's all right. We're all going to be all right.
Right.
I mean, it's never too late to be, it's never too late to be fully responsible. But I don't think anybody is entirely responsible from the get go. And even, you know, we tend to see people, I mean, I know guys that have a very, I would say, heightened sense of responsibility, like guy that sings in my band. I mean, he's the eldest of three brothers, and he's like, he's the captain, you know. He has an extraordinary ability to soak up responsibility, you know. But, you know, and I'm not saying this about him, but I've seen guys got like that who then get it between the eyes when they least expect it to, because they haven't been tending the garden, you know. Because they haven't been really, they've been subjugating, you know, their younger selves, you know, because, you know, I mean, at different times in our lives, we get, you know, things get expected of us, right? I think that very few of us get raised appropriately every step of the way, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like we get treated like a 4-year-old when we're 4, we get treated like a 10-year-old when we're 10, we get treated like a 16-year-old. More often than not, we're either babied or we're expected to be more than we are, depending on the experience. It's, I mean, I quite enjoy it, and you may have noticed, I don't have a problem talking about this stuff, and I find it quite fascinating, actually. I just find myself eternally fascinating, and I say that meaning, like, I find humanity,
yes.
I find all of us eternally fascinating. I mean, I know more about me than I do about you.
Right.
So, you know, I can put the pieces together when I, you know, when I weigh up my own existence. But essentially, it's all about being the best, showing up for the day, you know, and being the best person that we can be, right, with the people that we encounter.
Yeah.
You know, there's something in one of the books that gets read in 12-step programs where it says, you know, essentially, you know, our job today is to have the best possible relationship with everybody that we encounter on a day-by-day basis. And I say that's the biggest fucking understatement,
right.
You know, in the whole, you know, in all of the writings of the 12-step program, because it's like, well, yeah, but, you know, that's actually a pretty tall order, you know, because it's like, well, what about them? What right. are they doing? You
right.
know, well, that's not my responsibility. My responsibility is to just, you know, as I go through the day, just show the best side of myself. to everybody that I encounter. And it's not always easy. You don't always want to do that, do you?
I certainly don't. But I will say, and this is not in a sycophantic way, you are so surprisingly nice. And I will say that many people say that, not the surprising part, but they're just like, he's just so nice. Mm. It's not really a terribly common thing, I think, particularly for somebody in your position. I don't know. But it's notable, I think, that you're doing that. The expression I find the most ridiculously, like, sort of thrown off and are like, are you kidding me? Just live life on life's terms. Mm. It's like, do you get how hard life's terms are when you say that to me casually? It's just, they're rough. And I'm understanding them more and more every day.
Right. I mean, you know, to a degree, you can kind of choose the way in which those terms are framed, you know, and we can look at, I mean, you know, this is going to, I mean, anybody that's listening to it isn't in a 12-step program, you know, one of the slogans is, you know, I don't always know what's best for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and that, when I first heard that, I'd be like, wait a minute, what, how can that possibly be? You know, and then I'd realize that, well, no, sometimes things happen not according to my wishes, and they're great.
Absolutely.
And it's like, and if I'd have done it that way, I mean, the band will often argue about, like, I think we should do this. We should go here and do this. And somebody else will say, well, I don't think we should. I think we should, you know, and we'll have this, like, back and forth. And I don't get my way, let's say. And I'm disgruntled, you know, and it's something different happens to what I wanted to have happen. And a few weeks later, I go, damn, I'm so glad that happened. So, and I think that when you can acknowledge something like that, it opens your world in a way, because we're basically, most of us are just trying to, like, keep everything together. I can just keep things under control, if I can just keep everything in the bag, in my arms, and hold it really tight, I'm going to be okay. And the idea that actually, you know what, things can happen and they're going to be good. They may not be the things you want to have happen. I mean, and that gets us to, like, the idea of faith, right? Which is like this idea that you can let go of something and go, okay, you know what? All right, so it's not going to go the way I want it to go, but I'm going to have faith that it's going to be okay and it's going to resolve itself in a productive, you know, positive way. I mean, all of these things have been so, so useful to me. Yeah. I mean, I was raised a Catholic,
right?
But I had no real faith in the God of Catholic Church. There were too many rules and too many ideas that I couldn't wrap my mind around. I mean, I remember I used to sit in school. I went to a Catholic school and I was like six. And, you know, they'd be telling us just the simple things like, yes, well, Jesus walked on the water and he did this. And then there was the, you know, these miracles. Yes, when he fed, 5,000 people showed up and everybody was hungry, but one person had a loaf and two fish, and they passed the basket around, and everybody ate. Everybody got something, and there were still crumbs left in the basket. And I'm thinking, how can that be? And the trick, and I did write about this, but the trick with Catholicism, you put your hand up in the class, and you say, please, miss, I don't understand that. And they say, well, you don't even ask. You don't even ask a question, because if you ask a question, you could, well, let's say God could wreak revenge on you tonight. So you kind of have to, like, everything in Catholicism is like, okay, I believe. And actually, when I got sober, somebody gave me Emmett Fox's mm-hmm. Sermon on the Mount. And he translates the ideas of the Bible. And one of the things he says is that when food or drink is talked about in the Bible, such as when Jesus changed the water into wine mm-hmm. at the wedding at Cana, you know, one of the great, you know, Bible stories, you know, he's talking about spiritual nourishment. And actually, you know, 5,000 people were together. Jesus spoke. He did his Anthony Robbins thing. He spoke and everybody left nourished in their hearts and souls. Now that makes perfect sense to me.
Why couldn't your teacher have answered that?
Well, because they don't think like along those lines, do they?
Right.
I mean, I don't, or at least the Catholic teachers that I encountered didn't have, you know, they didn't present that kind of thinking. So I've had to go, you know, I've had to go elsewhere to get those kinds of ideas. But the idea that, you know, things are going to get, that I don't have to be the one that makes everything happen, that I can let things happen, and that the chances are that that things will work out at least as good as if I'd have been at the wheel, or maybe even better.
I find that when I can remember that, always true. When I can't remember that, which is about half the time,
yeah,
never true. Mm. But you know, getting fired or bad things, things that are inarguably bad, when I can just really believe that, always better. Yeah. Always. Well, okay, so we have to get towards wrapping up. Final question. What would you tell somebody who is struggling, believes they may have a problem? What are your words of wisdom for that?
Well, I mean, I think that the, you know, 12-step program of like Alcoholics Anonymous is out there. Everybody's heard of it. Most people who aren't a part of it think it probably wouldn't be for them.
Yeah.
I think that it's a very, it's the most inclusive church you will ever visit. I've had some extraordinary experiences taking one very old and dear friend and introducing him to the program. And really, you know, just watching the people in the meetings just carry him off, you know, and surround him with love. And I mean, it's a remarkable thing. Anybody that takes that step, you know, that actually, like, you know, goes online and checks out, you know, 12-step meetings in their neighborhood and like finds something that kind of works for them and goes along, I think it's always worth, you know, it's always worth taking that step. It may not be exactly what you need, but if you feel like you've got a problem, you know, what have you got to lose? Like 2 hours out of your life,
right,
to check it out. And you know, I think once you've got one foot in, a lot of people talk about it as being a cult. I definitely don't see it like that. I don't see it as any more of a cult than being a supporter of Chelsea FC or, you know, a fan of Kendrick Lamar. It's just a group of people that have this similar interest, and they're together. They're attacking this problem. It's almost like they're like these laboratories, aren't they, all over the world, you know, where people are just trying to work through these issues, these personal and social issues. But I say, you know, go online, check out meetings local to you, and you know, check it out.
And on that note of calling them labs, which I love because I've never heard that, you don't like the first lab, there's probably another one near you,
right,
or a third or a fourth. So well, this has been fabulous. Thank you so much for doing this. And you, listener, thank you. There's more than one. I want you to know that, listeners. But I'm talking individually to you. If you like this podcast and this episode, please go review it. Why not? It's wonderful to hear from you. And I really, really appreciate that. And this has been an amazing episode. And I have a tagline, but I'm always forgetting it. It's a new thing. We all have dark, so we can all share our light. So go out there and hustle your light, light hustler. I think that was it. Okay, bye.